Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Good morning, and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have an interesting conversation about taste. Actually, today, that conversation started at 10:30 because my guest and I just couldn't wait until we were on the air. But before we get to that conversation and I introduce our guest, Tamar Adler, whom I'm so excited to have here in the studio, I just wanted to report in on that members-only party last Sunday at Roberta's, which was quite a bash. And for those of you who enjoy the Hearst Ranch jingle on the break sometimes, the commercial for Hearst Ranch Meats, well, we got a live performance like I've never heard. He was singing Single Ladies in that deep country voice. It was quite a do. And the sort of thing that only members, only of a radio station such as Heritage Radio Network could ever experience. So go to the website and join if you like what you hear on this show and on all the great shows on this network. And also go out there and buy this book, An Everlasting Meal. My guest today is the author of that book, Tamar Adler. Welcome to Bushwick.
Thank you.
And we are about to start what I hope will be an everlasting conversation about food, which is something that we share, that many people listening share. But I think, Tamar, you have a very unique perspective and one that ought to be less unique. And I just am so excited to have you here to talk about that and about all sorts of things about eating.
Thanks.
Let's start with the book, which is how would you even characterize it? I know that at the beginning you say MFK Fisher is sort of your model, and yet it's a book that probably more than any cookbook I've ever read is about cooking, and yet it isn't a cookbook.
I do a tricky and unfair thing at the beginning of the book, which is say what it isn't.
Right.
It's not a cookbook or a memoir. I think it's a narrative about cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And people have told me that it's a philosophy of cooking, and I'm glad I didn't think that that's what it was, because I probably wouldn't have written a book of philosophy.
Right, and it would have been less enjoyable somehow.
Yeah. To me and everybody else. I do think it's sort of a story of cooking that starts at the beginning, almost like reinventing the way that we do it, the way we think about it. That's what I hope it is, kind of an alternative version of the cooking narrative.
Hmm. Well, I have to say that there aren't many books I read about food that make me want to get in the kitchen and do something and save the vegetable cooking water like my grandmother. I always heard my great-grandmother did, all that sort of stuff. And so, one person commends you at really getting into the mind of a cook and what it means to cook well. Why do you think cooking is important?
I think that cooking is really a means of, it's a means of production, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's something that is fundamental to our existence. I also think it's incredibly freeing. Mm. And that when we don't know how to cook, we're essentially in thrall to other people. And right now, to be honest, it's largely corporations to do our cooking for us. And that's an incredibly hampering and even paralyzing situation to be in.
Some people would think liberating, no?
I think it can be both.
Right.
I think that the more we learn about our food system and the more we learn about the negative impact of really big food production or the potentially negative impact, the more important it seems to be able to make choices. And cooking does enable that.
Mm-hmm.
If you know how to do it, then you're in a great position to choose to or choose not to. And just to be flexible in the face of a really changing food landscape.
Mm.
And I think that there is a big difference between knowing how to cook and being obsessive about cooking or obsessive about food. And I think that's a distinction I try to draw.
Oh, let's talk about that then, because we were talking about that earlier a little bit. So what is the distinction? Because Well, what was funny as I read the book is that you articulate very beautifully, I might add. You are, I have not had your food, but I have digested your writing, and it's really beautiful and thoughtful and funny. But what is the relationship between obsessive about food? You seem to obsess about the details that you see and use in the kitchen or think about food, and yet not a food obsessive. Could you just explain that distinction a little bit?
I think that the reason that a lot of people don't cook is because they think that to cook well and eat well is like being a huge fan of something. You know, there's the word foodie, but it's sort of like feeling like in order to play catch in the yard with your kid, you have to be a professional pitcher.
Right.
And I really do think that's the difference. Or in order to, you know, to navigate an argument at home, you have to be a Supreme Court lawyer. You don't. It's right. This over, it really is an over articulation of something that should be really much more personal and intimate. And I think that this idea that you are supposed to be, you know, full of ardor and passion for food is what keeps a lot of people from wanting to do it, because they feel like, well, I'm not passionate. I just sometimes like to go into the kitchen and cut up an apple and a, you know, a block of cheese and some bread, and that's what I want to serve my kid, because I don't want to spend a ton of time on it. And that is cooking. That's wonderful cooking.
Right. So much of what we have come to associate with the excitement of food has come from chefs and celebrity chefs, or even just, you know, people, chefs we read about profiled in the New York Times magazine. Are chefs good cooks?
This is also something we started to touch on before. I think chefs can be good cooks. I think that the relationship between a home cook and a chef is much more distant than we feel like it is supposed to be. The number of people who respond to my question, "Do you cook?" by saying, "I am no chef," is overwhelming.
Wow.
And
a little
I always,
sad, actually.
It is sad, because I always say, well, why would you be?
Right.
Of course you're not. I think a chef is somebody that has the administrative and logistical tasks of running a restaurant and a restaurant kitchen.
But which you have done. You have worked in restaurant kitchens, and you have been, quote unquote, a chef or a professional cook, let's say. Did that inform this distance, or this? Did that somehow reflect, help you reflect on what food meant and what cooking means for you?
Yeah, I think it's funny. There was a chef at Chez Panisse who once told me that he thought I would always think of myself as a cook. And I think that that's true. I've always had a sense that the way I approached food was somehow less professional than personal. But definitely working in a restaurant kitchen made me understand the difference between between professional cooking and home cooking. Professional cooks and professional chefs have to have technique, and that is wonderful and important. But also so much of it is what you need to do to run the machine that is a restaurant. And that has nothing to do with home cooking. And that was definitely brought to, you know, I learned that doing it. Yeah.
Did you enjoy that experience in the professional kitchen?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved cooking. I still miss it.
Oh. And now you write most of the time.
Yes.
Right?
I procrastinate and write.
As all good writers do, I think.
Just, good, bad, the whole lot.
How did you come to learn about food? Did you grow up in an environment where food was really important?
Our mother was a great cook. Mm-hmm. Ours is my brother and me, and he also cooks professionally.
Oh.
And my mother, who was a developmental psychologist when we were growing up, also cooks professionally now. She left it to become a personal chef. And she cooked incredible, really simple meals and did a lot of what I talk about in the book in order to make it possible to cook every night for a family of four and also work full time. So she cooked big batches of beans and roasted big batches of vegetables and cooked a lot of rice and then would sort of assemble various meals over the course of a week. And food was great and it wasn't stressful and it didn't take forever. And there was very little that was doctrinal and also very little that was absolute. It just sometimes it was organic. It often wasn't. sometimes there were tacos that came from one of those
sheets of crispy tacos.
Exactly. And sometimes it was, you know, a beautiful fish and escargot casserole. And I think that I learned to see it as completely part of a whole and exciting and engaged life.
Which actually is something I want to get back to. But first, I want to remind listeners that you can call and ask questions of Tamar about cooking, about her philosophy of cooking, or her experiences in some of the great kitchens in the country, in the world, really, by calling us at 718-497-2128. Or you can send us an email question at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Or if you prefer 140-character messages, you can tweet us at TasteMattersHRN. So you, each chapter of your book, and I know that you're thinking about food and you're writing about food, does not begin and end at this book, but there is an object and people can get it and they can read it and they can get to know you, your approach to food a little bit more. Each one has a little story about, which isn't about an ingredient or isn't about an approach, but is sort of a, well, it's an underlying philosophy. Don't throw things away. End the meal on a simple note. Those sorts of things. Did you always know you were going to write something like this, or did it come out of the cooking and you're paying attention to your cooking? It just seems so almost not accidental. Does that make sense?
Yeah. People have asked me that before. People have asked me whether I did things that I did before the book in order to write the book, or whether I had always planned to write the book. Did you mean the opposite?
Well, sort of. I just did. Did you think you had something to share? Because that seems to, you're not as good a writer to pull off not manipulating your life that way to make a good story, like some people who read the Bible and, you know.
I read How to Cook a Wolf by M.F.K. Fisher when I did not cook professionally yet, but I felt as though it cleared something up and transformed eating and cooking for me. And I wished when I read it that someday I could do something similar, because I have always loved food and words in a way that was really bound, and I always had a hard time choosing one or the other. And you usually do have to, just because life is fairly linear. So I was a magazine editor, and then I was a cook, and I've flip-flopped. But I always wanted to find a way to do something similar, which was, for me, to give people cooking. She gave people cooking in that book. She gave it to them as a solution to what seemed like really harsh polarities. And I think I wanted to do that for a really long time, and I don't know if I had... I know I didn't have the cooking skill, and I don't think I had really developed a philosophy that was worth passing along. And then at some point, today's polarities really kind of reared up for me, and I stopped and I looked inward, and it turned out that I had developed something that might have a chance at giving some part of cooking to people.
How would you articulate those polarities?
I think that they are between people feeling like they have to spend an enormous amount of time and money and effort and eat according to Michael Pollan and Alice Waters, is what they interpret as, you know, kind of dicta, or just do it wrong, you know, or do what works in their lives, which means doing it wrong. They either do it right, which is a huge life change, and they devote all of these resources to it and make a lot of, you know, a lot of huge shifts, or they keep on with their lives and feel forever guilty and like they're messing up, and they're not, you know, and they feel torn between a desire to do it right and what feels like the realities of their lives. And those are not the two options.
Right. Well, and it's funny, you're reminding me as you're speaking of the sense in the book that you give people permission, as you have done a little bit on the show already, to mess up, to not do it the same way twice, to do the things that we see as the ideal, as the goal in food, because of the way we're bombarded by all these perfect images and even just the conversations we have on the show about perfect things and delicious stuff. And I do think that that's part of the intimidation people have. And then the worst thing that happens is they feel bad and then they just go eat at McDonald's anyway, because why bother? You know, right. You throw your hands up. We're going to take a quick break. We have, we'll be right back after a short musical interlude. And if you have questions, remember to give us a call at 718-497-2128.
Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with Tamar Adler, who is worried her answers aren't short enough, which is exactly why we love being on internet radio, where time really doesn't mean anything. How do you characterize your food? You're reading it, it seems Italian. You seem to cook like an Italian to me, but are there influences that you pull out?
I think it's Italian and Middle Eastern.
Oh, Middle Eastern.
I think it's everything that's olive oil and garlic and bread based.
I'm sure your neighbors love you. And
and close friends.
And what are you looking for new and interesting, or are you content in sort of exploring what you know and getting deeper?
I don't think I am. I'm interested in observing myself as a cook and an eater. I've noticed recently that I have been drawn toward restaurants and cuisines that I haven't been since I last lived in New York in the early aughts, which are noodle places out in mm-hmm. Sunset Park and Flushing. I think that for a long time, I kind of felt like I just wanted to function like a provincial and regionally based European cook and sort of, you know, use exactly what was available and, cook it in the simplest way possible. And I think I kind of had a negative reaction and almost sort of a pendulum swing against culinary tourism. And after, you know, a few years working on a book and then another year doing cooking classes and special dinners based on boiled food with lots of olive oil and garlic and bread, I have been really excited about taquerias and hand-pulled noodles recently.
But probably to eat. Not to bring home and cook, which is...
Yeah, I have become not particularly interested in developing anything. Yeah. I think that I develop my entertaining and hosting more than anything else. I'm, you know, having more and more people over with every passing day, and there are footpaths getting worn down between my front door and my dining room. But no, I don't. I think that I kind of spend less conscious thought on what I'm going to make all the time, and more conscious thought on how to serve it to people, to whom to serve it. Yeah, it's interesting. It's becoming part of the texture of my life in an unexamined and really comfortable way, which I'm happy with. You know, I love reading about Lulu Perrot, who's one of Alice's great influences, and the way she entertained, which was by serving huge groups of people constantly on anchovy toasts and whole sardines and various constellations of stale bread and little bits and pieces, and then, you know, soups that changed based on what was around. And it just seemed effortless and not incredibly experimental or adventurous, but calm and focused and hers.
But new enough for us from our world, where new and progress and choice and variety are all the things that we want, that she's been written about for generations, Lulu, those lunches. I feel like I've had lunch with her between Richard Olney and Alice and Coleman Andrews and everyone, but something about that really resonates. So let's get to that question of food receding. I mean, here you are immersed in the world of food and food magazines and shows about food, entertaining all the time. And yet you said something earlier that the last thing you want to do is talk about food over dinner. Say more about that.
That is exactly true. And I have a hard time keeping myself from trying to ask people to shift the conversation from talking about food to talking about absolutely anything else over dinner. It seems almost like an experimental art installation to sit there and eat and talk about what you're eating. It's sort of like this strange layer upon layer of experience that is tends to be just that's what feels obsessive to me. I think that in order for food to be something, like you said earlier, where all of the choices are good, where you don't have to care so much that it's all you think about in order to make a good choice, but rather choosing food is implicitly a good thing, and making good choices is sort of the default. In order for it to be like that, I think it does need to become part of life. And I think that's a lot of the reason that I wrote the book, because imagine if you really could start eating well and enjoying eating and cooking from exactly where you were, with exactly what you have in your house. It just seems like a lot more people would want to do it then. It seems almost like why wouldn't you?
You mean dinner doesn't start with mail order?
Like with going out to buy ingredients.
To, in specific stores on Lexington Avenue, for instance.
And finding this assortment of spices that you'll never use again and oils that you'll never use again. And I think that it really is... I mean, it's why I cook like I do. And I think I even have a tendency to... overdo it sometimes, where friends will come over and they will eat, you know, wonderful bread from my local bakery and these amazing canned sardines that I got at Zingerman's and you know, garlic mayonnaise.
And they're still your friends?
They're still my... I did once serve bean broth to people, and I talk about this in the book, but not only did I serve bean broth, and I think this was a little bit cheeky, not intentionally, but it was what I had because I had been making beans, and it was just the first course was the broth from the beans. I had forgotten to heat it up, so it wasn't just bean broth, but it was cold.
Excellent.
But after that, they
was
started...
Was there a war going on?
I think internally for all of them. But they no longer feel intimidated by the idea of inviting me to dinner.
That's excellent, because they must be intimidated, right? I wonder if they practice the Coco Chanel thing, and when you're coming, they take three things away, three ingredients, two things off the table, the way that she used to take something off before she left the house.
Yeah, I think they do. And but But now they also will just serve me sardines or
in a can. Yeah. That's great. Let's talk, since it's the name of our show, for a little bit about taste, which I, you know, is sort of underlies so much of what you write about food and an ability to taste, and even sort of playing with your own tastes and how you think that comes is expressed in cooking.
I think that deliciousness is not considered seriously enough in cooking.
And you don't mean umami or glutamate, do you?
Exactly. Right. No, I just mean deliciousness.
Right.
I mean that it is this thing that's sort of hidden in plain sight, that the goal of everything you cook should be deliciousness, and that it doesn't really matter what it is, and you don't even really have to unpack that much. Mm-hmm. It should taste good. You should enjoy it. And when people, I think that's one of the things that's so freeing about cooking. Because what if all you had to do was shoot for something tasting great? People are incredibly more skilled in the kitchen mm-hmm. when they are suddenly charged with just making things taste good to them.
Hmm. Well, that to them sometimes gets people into trouble, no? I mean, you had a formative experience eating well and have traveled and tasted great things. How do you get people to rise to the taste? You know, because hot sauce tastes strong. Maybe not good. I don't know.
Well, I think one way is for people to start thinking about what it is that they are enjoying when they taste. So when people really like hot sauce, often they really like vinegar and acid.
Right.
And they like spice. And if people were only able to think, I like vinegar and acid and spice, they would know a lot more about what to do with what is in their refrigerator. Because probably if they just squeeze lemon juice on it, they'll like it.
Mm-hmm. You're reminding me of two friends who thought they hated Chinese food because they'd only ever had Cantonese food. And it's about texture and, you know, subtlety, and then they realized there was a whole world out there of other things, and it opened them up to find the things that they liked in this great cuisine of the world. I mean, it's a funny revelation that they both now make fun of me for saying, well, I guess I do like Chinese food.
Right.
Pulled noodles and all. if you had... I mean, I know you have lots of advice for someone starting out, but someone listening who wants, you know, who's making dinner tonight, like, where do you start? What do you tell them to do?
Well, I tell them to boil a pot of water. Always.
And what's going in there? Anything?
Anything. Mm. I think that the number one thing that people need to do when they're learning how to cook is walk into their kitchen, put as big a pot as they have on the stove full of water, salt it, stand there and taste it, and then put anything in it. I mean, that's not true. Not anything. But if all they did was put pasta in it and toss that with butter, it would be probably better than a lot of the stuff that we make based on recipes that we clip from whatever cookbook that's giving us or magazine that's giving us the eighth version of spinach and feta cheese and strawberry
right.
salad.
Okay, so I can hear the taps running right now. Everyone's got their pot filling with water in anticipation of something good for lunch, I guess, now before dinner.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking with us, Tamar. The book is An Everlasting Meal, and it really is a book about how to live your life with food, how to put food in your life. Next week, we're going to, as we like to do on this show, we're going from the ridiculous to the extreme. A few weeks ago, we had a vegan, and then we had a butcher, and this week, we have someone celebrating home cooking, and next week, we have Pete Wells, the restaurant critic of the New York Times, whose job it is to eat in every new, hot, trendy restaurant in this great city of new, hot, trendy restaurants. You're listening to Taste Matters, and every week, we are talking about taste. Before next Wednesday, do us a favor and eat something delicious and think about it a little bit more than maybe you normally do. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.